From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, just how politically prejudiced do you think you are? For example, would you marry a Republican if you're a Democrat? According to a statistical analysis by The Atlantic, Salt Lake and Summit counties are pretty prejudiced. Amanda Ripley of The Atlantic says this kind of bias is growing in the country. She'll join us to explain what that means and talk about the least prejudiced place. We'll be right back.
KUER's mobile app gives you everything you love about our station on the go. Stream KUER live on your phone. Listen to NPR and local stories on demand. Then shift gears and listen to our 24/7 classical music station or explore podcasts like Radio West and 45 Days. It's all on the KUER app. Download it for free for Android or iOS, wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Think about your own circle of friends. How many of them are people of a different political party? How many of them disagree with you about really important stuff like abortion and immigration, but still you manage to get along? The reporter Amanda Ripley said, this just used to be the way it was in this country. Your political opinions didn't really matter all that much in your relationship. You had mixed political marriages and mixed neighborhoods and church groups. But that's not really how it is anymore. And just look at the numbers. Ripley points out in a new piece in The Atlantic that the rate of politically mixed marriages in this country has declined by 50%. Since 1973. 50 years ago, when you were dating, it practically didn't matter who they voted for. Now, it can be a deal breaker. Ripley says this kind of sorting leads to a different kind of prejudice, not racial or religious bigotry, but political. The effects, by the way, are the same: distortion and stereotypes and hatred. In Ripley's story, she uses data to find the least politically prejudiced place in America. And then she goes there to find out what's different about that place. Today in the program, Amanda Ripley is joining us to talk about what she found. She's an investigative journalist and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Her article is called The Least Politically Prejudiced Place in America, and it appears in this month's issue of the magazine. She joined us from the studios of The Atlantic in Washington, D.C.
This all started because I was interested in writing about political polarization, but I didn't want to do yet another story lamenting it, right? So in other cases where we have really, really difficult problems that feel hopeless, it can be really helpful to look at the outliers, to find places that are different than everywhere else. So to do that, we needed some data. It's hard to measure political disdain for the other side, but it's not impossible. And so we worked with a startup polling and analytics firm called PredictWise, and they did a sort of model that's really interesting. It's imperfect, but it was a lot better than what we had before, which was nothing. This all started, PredictWise did a poll of 2,000 Americans asking 14 questions, some of which are pretty standard now in the research that tries to get at partisan disdain. And they're questions like, how would you feel if a close family member married a Democrat or a Republican? Yeah. You know, how well do you think the term selfish or patriotic describes Democrats versus Republicans? Those kinds of things, really trying to get at people's feelings about the other side, separate and apart from their feelings about the policies and ideas of the other sides. So once we did that, we knew a lot about those 2,000 people. And PredictWise knows a lot about 300 million Americans. And so putting those things together, we were able to figure out that there were certain traits that seem to correlate, at least in our analysis, with higher levels of political disdain. And it's interesting because the most politically prejudiced people in America right now don't seem to be the most vulnerable ones. So they found that the most judgmental partisans tended to be white, urban, older. That was a big one. Highly educated, politically engaged, and politically segregated, which was, to me, the most interesting one, because they can look at the neighborhood level all over the country and get an estimate of how much political diversity there is. And what they found is that more political diversity tends to lead to more political open-mindedness. And the inverse is also true. But most of us, many of us, are living in places with very little political diversity at this point for a bunch of reasons. And so if you find a place that has more political diversity at the neighborhood level, that probably means that people have more relationships across the political divide. And we know from decades of research into all forms of prejudice that that's a really important way to mitigate people's tendency to demonize the other side.
Yeah. So the data points you to this county in upstate New York, Jefferson County. And in the article, you key in on one town in the county. Let's talk about Watertown. What's it like? And maybe start where you do in the article with the winters, which can be, I guess, kind of brutal.
Yeah. I was sort of surprised. I mean, I thought maybe we would end up somewhere in the Midwest or something like that. But no, the data suggested that this county in far upstate New York, just east of Lake Ontario, seem to be unusually low in political prejudice. And it is a brutal place in the winter. It's a place where the snow comes in feet, not inches.
Yeah.
And it's a small town. Its main claim to fame before this was that it's the home of Fort Drum, which is where the 10th Mountain Division is based, the U.S. Army.
Right.
So that place has obviously injected a lot of federal money and also some jobs and some amount of diversity, though not a huge amount, into the area. So I went up there to see, you know, were we right? Was this place any different than, say, Washington, D.C., where I live, which, sort of like where you live, did not do well at all on our ranking of political prejudice?
Yeah. What do we mean by political tolerance? Because it's not just that people agree on issues, even big issues. It's that they, as you say in the piece, give each other the benefit of the doubt. It's one of the things that you found in Watertown. So talk a little bit about how you were thinking about what tolerance represents. It's not that people compromise their values. It's just you have to be willing to compromise, I guess.
Yeah, this is really tricky, and I almost feel like we don't have the vocabulary even for it. I mean,
yeah.
We had big debates at the Atlantic about whether to call this prejudice or something else.
Mm-hmm.
But the more research that comes out, and there is some really good research that's coming out only recently, it looks a lot like prejudice. And basically, it means that people are judging each other's character and moral core.
Yeah.
Based on their perception of the other side's political ideology and affiliation. So, you know, we mentioned some research in the piece that Americans are now reliably judging each other's political affiliation based on whether people go to Chick-fil-A or Chipotle or Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks. And so we're using these cues to try to sort one another, which is what happens whenever you get a very sort of tribal conflict. People try to find ways to easily sort each other. And obviously skin color is the way that has been done in the United States historically and other places. But when you don't have that, then people look for other cues. And the problem is we're making mistakes on both sides. So
yeah, it's
Republicans,
not real.
Yeah, like you get distortions.
Yeah.
Not only you might be wrong that someone who goes to Chick-fil-A might be a Democrat, obviously. but in addition, more importantly, you start thinking that all Republicans are one thing and all Democrats are one thing and no one is one thing. And we know from the research that Democrats are now assuming that all Republicans are much more wealthy and cruel than they actually are. And Republicans are assuming that Democrats are much more godless and radical than they actually are.
A not insignificant number of Republicans and Democrats said that their opponents lacked the traits to be considered fully human. That seems like a big deal.
Yeah, nearly 20% of Democrats and Republicans said that in a survey by Nathan Calmo and Liliana Mason, two political scientists. And so 20%, I mean, it's one in five. That's a lot. And it's partly because, unlike other prejudices, there's no, like, social taboo against political prejudice. Yeah. In fact, it's considered totally legitimate. And I get that, and it is different than other kinds of prejudice for lots of reasons. But the more I looked at the research, I mean, the reality is that the vast majority of Americans choose their political affiliation based on their parents mm-hmm. and where they grew up. And they don't change. They make those decisions around like age 18 to 21, and they don't change even when their economic situation might change, suggesting that their policy preferences might change. They very rarely change. So people are in many ways treating politics sort of like religion. And that yeah. doesn't mean that people shouldn't be held accountable for their choices, but it also doesn't mean that their choices reflect deep moral failing necessarily.
Well, this was startling. According to one survey you mentioned in the piece, I think it was 15% of Republicans, 20% of Democrats said the country would just be better off if large chunks of people in the other party, and I'll just quote it here, just died.
That's right. And they're doing more research on that, those same political scientists, to figure out if people meant... What did people mean?
Like yeah.
How do you want them to die? Like of old age or, you know, some other way? And
yeah.
so.
Well, but it gets at that, like that there's some big judgment that's being made about not just that they disagree, like it's not just anodyne policy disagreements. It's that half of Democrats and Republicans say that they are actually frightened by their political opponents. Like this is really deep, deep stuff,
yeah.
it seems.
Yeah, like we think the other side is like rotten to the core. Or not all of us think that, but more than really makes sense or is healthy for a country in which, you know, we need to live together and work together. One of the most startling statistics is the increase in people who say they'd be upset if their child married someone from the other side.
Yeah.
So in the 60s, it was 4% of Democrats and 4% of Republicans said they would mind. So basically no one, right?
Right, right.
And then today, according to an Atlantic and PRI poll in December, 45% of Democrats said they'd be unhappy if their child married a Republican versus 35% of Republicans who'd be unhappy if their child married a Democrat. So, you know... Huge increase in both sides. And that's a good indicator typically on prejudice. Like that's why for many years we've studied how people feel about interracial marriage or marrying someone from a different religion. You know, that's a very good indicator to show you how strongly people feel about these differences.
I find it interesting when people go to dinner parties and you're just chatting people up. I don't think most of us feel all that nervous about making assumptions about people's politics and just sort of spouting their own views. And if that's, you kind of get at this in the piece, is that that we're sorting ourselves. And we'll get into this a little bit more later, but that we've sorted ourselves into these groups so we comfortably can feel like we don't have to tread very carefully on our political views when we're in these dinner parties, you know, in the neighborhood.
I guess depending on the diversity of your neighborhood, right? So in a place like Watertown, I think some people felt that way, but then other people felt more circumspect, like they couldn't talk about politics the way they once did because it was so explosive. But certainly in Washington, D.C., where I live, you can pretty much assume where most people stand on Donald Trump, despite this being the capital. Only 4% of the residents here voted for him. So it's pretty homogeneous
yeah.
on politics.
Well, I guess that is the point. Watertown, and I'm sure others, is different. And we'll sort of talk about why and how as we go along. I wanted to back up a bit and have you talk a little bit about who is likely to be prejudiced. You mentioned this just a moment ago. And this is surprising because there's this basic belief that the more educated you are, you know, the less inclined you are going to be to discriminate based on someone's economic circumstance or sexual orientation or, you know, or ethnicity. But it doesn't seem like that applies when it comes to politics, because the more educated people are, I guess the more partisan they are, the more intolerant they are about politics.
Yeah, that was a surprising one on the one hand, because you would think that education would lead to less stereotyping. But on the other hand, there is a lot of research that when it comes to other divisive issues like climate change, more education doesn't lead to more knowledge or less disagreement. In fact, what people do is highly educated people have more confidence in their ability to dispute facts that they don't like, right? So they can always point to the sample size or something else to make themselves feel better about any facts that are inconvenient.
Amanda Ripley. Her article, The Least Politically Prejudiced Place in America, appears in this month's issue of The Atlantic. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is listener-supported public radio. And our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, just how politically prejudiced do you think you are? For example, would you marry a Republican if you're a Democrat? According to a statistical analysis by The Atlantic, Salt Lake and Summit counties are pretty prejudiced. Only Grand County is worse in this state. Amanda Ripley of The Atlantic says this kind of bias is growing in the country, and she's joining us to explain what that means and to talk about the least prejudiced place. Her article appears in this month's issue of The Atlantic. So one of the things you mention is that the people who are less tolerant politically are older, they're, as we said, more highly educated, they're more engaged in politics, they tend to be white, they tend to be urban. So talk about how Watertown is different. For all those obvious reasons, it's white. That is the thing that seems to be typical of intolerance, but it's younger and it's not as educated. And I guess it's not urban. I mean, it's mostly suburban and rural, I guess, that region.
Correct. Yeah. And the other important thing is that it's politically diverse. So nothing crazy, but compared to, so let's take a comparison. Suffolk County, Massachusetts, which includes Boston, which we found to be the most politically prejudiced in the country. 9 out of every 10 couples share the same partisan leaning, according to our estimates, in that county. So by comparison, it's 3 out of every 4 in Watertown. So you have more political diversity at the family level, which is hugely important, and also at the neighborhood level. So in Boston, 8 out of every 10 neighborhoods are politically homogenous. Mm-hmm. So you can really see these differences if you compare the extremes, right? I think part of it is if you're in a small town in a cold place where there is political diversity, you know, it's not in your interest to become too shrill. Yeah. And you happen to know people, and you happen to know them well, with whom you really disagree on politics. But because you know them, maybe they're your wife, maybe they're your neighbor.
Yeah.
And because you know them like that, it makes it really hard to just demonize them. It's just there's cognitive dissonance. And so you can still, and people do still, disagree profoundly, but it's harder to just dismiss one another.
It seems like one of the most important themes that I got from the piece is this idea of these personal interactions. So Watertown is as you say, it's pretty diverse politically. So people don't always agree, but because, as you say, they have to see each other, they have to interact. And this is how you put it in the piece. You say, instead of provoking rage, these disagreements, these encounters, this discomfort, provokes something more like complexity. Say something about that, because I thought this was really interesting. They don't always agree, but they just have to find a way around that discomfort that comes when you don't agree with someone.
Right. And it almost, here again, I almost felt like I didn't have the vocabulary to understand what I was seeing.
Yeah.
You know, but for example, I met these two women, both named Anne,
yep.
who have been friends for 45 years. They met at the same First Presbyterian Church in Watertown, and they both like to quilt and other things. They know each other's kids. They know each other's families. But one Anne brought the local chapter of Life Right, which is an anti-abortion education group, to Watertown.
Mm-hmm.
And the other Anne helped her husband bring Planned Parenthood to Watertown, just three blocks away.
Yeah.
So they know that they totally disagree on this thing that is very important to both of them. And when I talked to them about it, you know, they were so matter-of-fact, it was kind of disorienting. You know, the one Anne said, well, you know, it's never been contentious because we know each other.
Mm.
You know, she felt like that explained it. Like she knows this person as a complicated whole person who has more than one idea, who can admit when she's wrong, who is not just one thing, and vice versa.
It's interesting that how is it that they worked this out? Because you say your favorite part of the story almost is when Anne, one of the Annes, said, yeah, I may be wrong about this, and my opinions aren't the only ones that matter. I mean, why was that one of your favorite parts of what you were learning up in Watertown?
Something that is really lacking from our public discourse today is humility,
yeah.
of all kinds, right? There's no humility in the White House, that's clear. And there's no intellectual humility in political debates. There's not enough. You know, there's a whole study now of intellectual humility.
Mm.
It's funny that we have to call it that. But,
yeah.
you know, religions for many years, many centuries have focused on humility. But but when it comes to political beliefs, all that seems to go out the window for many of us. And so I was really struck by Anne's humility when she said, you know, I think we should be able to talk about things when we disagree because who knows, you know, there might be something I haven't thought of,
yeah.
Which is not something you hear every day from, let's see, anyone.
Yeah, yeah. I think the difficult thing when I've heard people talking about this piece is that what do you do when these are issues that matter deeply to who you think you are, like the issues that seem to matter the most to people's values, like immigration policies that, you know, cruelly break up families or keep people from opportunities and freedom. I mean, you can't, that's hard to compromise on that in some ways. Reproductive issues, you mentioned the two Annes. I mean, depending on your perspective, you know, you're either capriciously ending an innocent life or you're traumatizing women and taking choice. I mean, those seem like impasses. So how do you get beyond these issues that are really not just deeply held values, but get to a person's morality? Did you figure that out? How, I mean, the two Annes are good examples of that because you couldn't find two more sort of polar opposites, but those are deeply held issues.
Yeah, I'm so glad we're getting into this because this is like the heart of the matter,
yeah.
right? I mean, I think this is where we also lack the vocabulary. So here's what I think so far, and my opinion on this is evolving, right? But I think it's okay to get angry. It's
yeah.
good to disagree. It's important, imperative, right, that people organize, that people protest, that people vote, that people take action, particularly when there are core things that they really feel strongly about. And especially, let's not forget, many people whose lives are dramatically affected
yeah.
by these policy decisions. These aren't just, you know, preferences for movies,
mm-hmm.
right? Like these are big things that can shape people's trajectories in all kinds of ways and the way they see themselves and the way they see their community. So there is a difference between anger and contempt. And what I'm worried about is the contempt, because contempt has never persuaded anyone ever.
Mm.
So just be clear, I think, about what the goal is, right? Like if you're feeling contempt and expressing contempt for someone or someone's ideas, then just be clear about what your goal is. Yeah. If your goal is to show solidarity to people you feel like are being wronged, then that might work.
Yeah.
If your goal is to persuade, it will never work. It will have the opposite effect, and it tends to lead to more contempt. So there's a sort of moral argument here, mm-hmm. and there's also a pragmatic one,
yeah.
which is, you know, do you want to change people's lives for the better, or do you want to be right?
I'm not sure how much you want to talk about this because you didn't write about this in the piece necessarily, but I've heard you reveal that you and your husband don't or didn't agree politically. How much did that influence the way you were thinking about this story, if in fact you even want to talk about that?
Sure, yeah. No, it's funny because I didn't really even think about it. Mm-hmm. I never thought about until fairly late in the process, and I was looking at this research on Shanto Iyengar at Stanford's done some really impressive research on the effects of mixed marriages, politically speaking, and yeah. the way that people in mixed marriages still disagree but have like these much more complicated views of the other side. And I had never once thought about this as a plus.
Yeah.
Like I only, for me and my husband, I only saw it as like a challenge to overcome,
right.
Particularly when we were dating many years ago. So, but the conflict there was very much like, my worry that where we differed politically revealed a moral failing on his part, right? Mm-hmm. Like that was what I was worried about. And what I've learned about political conflict, but actually all conflict, is that it's almost never about what it seems to be about. Mm-hmm. So when it's really deep like that, you have to get underneath it and find out. Like what I really wanted to know was, is he a good person?
Yeah.
And once I found that out, all the political stuff kind of went away. Now, we still debate, right? And we actually agree on Trump, which makes our lives easier. I can see that there's a point at which this would be really hard to sustain. But in other ways, you know, it makes it harder for me to just dismiss millions of people because I don't know them, you know? And
yeah. yeah.
You know, while I disagree with a lot of things, there also are good points on the other side on certain issues. So, I mean, it's something that has definitely shaped me consciously and subconsciously, but I never saw it as something to be proud of, really, or happy about.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the things you write about that you found in Watertown is that when people disagreed, even about really deeply held stuff, they managed to be able to kind of get back to work or on with their lives without this lingering animosity. And it was just this matter of containing the discomfort. But as you point out, it was much harder to contain that kind of discomfort when you're online or you're dealing with strangers. When they're people you know and you're interacting with, you kind of have to do that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're all realizing is that humans were meant to be face-to-face.
Yeah.
You know, we tend to behave better that way for all kinds of reasons. But one of the threads that runs through the piece is that this kind of political comity is under threat everywhere, including in Watertown. And that's partly because they are subject to the same forces that we all are, right? Mm-hmm. Including social media and partisan TV news and other things. So yeah, you really could see that while it seemed more healthy in some ways, there was this sort of tremor, this undercurrent of people. There were people I met who had unfriended each other on mm-hmm. Facebook, who mm-hmm. had stopped speaking to each other, just as there are all over the country. And that was a real concern for people, even in Watertown.
Well, this gets us to a really important part of the story that you're mentioning, that you make this argument that one of the reasons people, even, you know, even smart, privileged, educated people become intolerant politically is because they've been manipulated by this process. And you write about how a lot of us in our, you know, social media accounts and Facebook pages are acting, you describe it as we're acting as kind of unwitting accomplices to politicians and, you know, media demagogues, as you put it, to basically just amplify the outrage. Basically, we're being manipulated and used. I think is how you're putting it.
Yeah, I think we're being played. And I know there's a certain rich irony in saying that as a member of the media.
Yeah.
I know that media demagogues and media platforms are part of how we got here. And politicians, particularly national politicians, and platforms, social media platforms that profit off of our attention. You know, it's not just one person's fault, right? Like there are many, but the reality is I do think we need to get to a place where we see the manipulation for what it is and where there's a shift in our norms so that that manipulation starts to feel, like manipulation and not like, truth.
Yeah. Well, it's about awareness, right? Once you become aware of it, you like, no way, dude, you're playing me. I get this. You're right?
Yeah. In fact, sometimes it's people in the media who ironically see this the most, you know?
Yeah.
Glenn Beck has a book that came out in the fall where he's arguing that there's an addiction to outrage and that he was addicted to it and he helped create this place where we're at and that he has regrets. And he did help create it. And he, in some ways, I think, continues to contribute to it, despite also wanting to get out of it. And that's the problem with intractable conflict. You kind of get sucked into this vortex and it's hard to get out. And when you try to get out, something else happens and there's a tweet and there's this and there's some other outrage and you get sucked back in.
It's like being in the mafia. It's hard to get out.
That's right.
You also mentioned in the piece, though, that there's more to the fact that Watertown's residents get along than the fact that it's a small town. Because, you know, there are plenty of people in the ranking you mentioned that are in small towns and did terribly in terms of their political tolerance. But there are some the civic culture of Watertown I found interesting, that they have a city paper, that they have a nonpartisan city council. I'm wondering what the military base, what sort of influence that. So what is it about that place, do you think, that can help us understand, you know, beyond the just face-to-face part that makes Watertown more tolerant or places like that?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I sort of wish I had gotten more into this in the piece, but it's already really long. But I feel like this is really important, you know. I think you're onto something really important, which is it's not just about the diversity of a place, however you define that. In this case, we're talking about political diversity, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's about, are there meaningful relationships that can really make the best of that diversity? And meaningful relationships come from many things, but one thing they come from is like a healthy community. So that means churches or synagogues or mosques that are healthy and welcoming. Or it could mean, like in the case of Watertown, a family-owned independent daily print newspaper, which is one way that people help express their disagreements and come up with hopefully a common sense of the facts in some cases. And so, you know, but also even like the YMCA in Watertown, 11% of the residents in that whole area were members, which is actually pretty high for a YMCA anywhere. And there were three Rotary clubs, not one, not two, right. Three. One for the morning, one for the lunchtime people, and one for people who could come in the evening. So these are things that suggest a kind of health, a civic infrastructure, which is influenced by lots of things.
I want to talk about another two of the characters that you mention in Watertown. This is Fred and Kathy Gary, the pastor of the Presbyterian Church there, and his wife. And again, it's a mixed marriage, I guess. He's pretty liberal. She's a Republican. But talk a little bit about Fred and Kathy, in particular Fred, because his experiences and what he's had to learn from, you know, preaching to people of different views is really interesting.
Yeah, no, Fred, so he, for 15 years, was the minister at the First Presbyterian Church in downtown Watertown. He'd been there for over 100 years. And he describes himself as one click above a communist. So he thinks of himself as pretty liberal.
Right.
And his wife, like you said, has voted Republican more often than not. So he said, you know, we cancel each other out on election day, which is something I heard a lot in Watertown. And they have five, they raised five kids in Watertown. And he does a couple of things that I think are important to understanding the health of Watertown. One thing is that for the past 5 years, he's held a weekly men's breakfast at the church every Monday morning. And he gets up early and cooks all the food himself in the church kitchen. And it's quite a spread. Like, I really was sort of, you know, envious of the Watertown men. But, you know, a huge spread of good breakfast food and coffee. And they talk about really hard issues facing the country. And they tether the conversation to good books, right? So they've read recently The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander and a book about the opioid crisis. And, you know, they're talking about things that are very divisive. But it works, Fred says, because first of all, they're well-fed, which is just human, right? And second of all, they know each other. He says there are some people in the men's group, which he describes them as to the right of Rush Limbaugh. So there's a big spectrum. And some people that he thinks are more liberal than he himself is. So a big spectrum of people. And the other trick, he says, is that they talk long enough to realize how much they don't know.
Yeah.
And so when that happens, they'll sometimes bring in an outside expert. So if they're studying the mass incarceration of African Americans, they might bring in someone who's actually been to prison or bring in a prosecutor. And they talk about that person's perspective to try to widen their understanding and deepen their understanding. And so in a lot of ways, the men's breakfast is like the opposite of social media, right? Like, it takes a long time. People get good food and you know each other. And there is also that culture of humility.
It seems like it's about one of the things that I learned, I think, from Fred is that you have to establish these boundaries. Because there's, you tell the story about he had given this sermon just after Donald Trump won. And it upset a lot of people who didn't agree with him about Donald Trump. And he just came to this conclusion that he couldn't talk about politics from the pulpit anymore. And I wanted to ask you about that. Do you is that one of the things that you've learned, is that some of the people have to, all of us maybe, have to establish these kind of boundaries? There are places we maybe shouldn't go.
Yeah, and that's one of the sort of most heartbreaking things, actually, is the people who are most adept at talking about this, like Fred Gehry, are finding they have a narrower and narrower space that they can, in which they can talk about politics. So he still talks about it at the men's breakfast, but he's decided not to talk about politics from behind the pulpit. But meanwhile, if you think about it, the rest of us talk about politics with no boundaries online, right?
Yeah.
And that's part of how we got here. So there's this strange parallel universe where we don't talk about it in person, which is really the best way to talk about politics, in person with people you know. And instead, we can say anything at any time to anyone online.
You mentioned Suffolk County. And in that county, only one in every, I think, 10 couples is politically mixed. Put that number in perspective for us historically, because it wasn't always the case that people felt, as you mentioned earlier, uneasy about picking a life partner by their political affiliations. How has that changed over time, and what do you think that means in some ways?
Yeah, this is a really big change. In fact, we could have done the whole story just about this. I mean, since the 1970s, as Shanto Iyengar has found, the rate of politically mixed marriages in the United States has declined by about 50%. So that's a big deal. And what it means is not only do the does the couple not get the benefit of other perspectives on politics necessarily, but their children don't. And so his research has shown that if children get to hear their parents disagreeing about politics, then children tend to have more complicated ideas about both sides. If they don't hear that, which most children currently do not and will not, then it's much easier, again, to stereotype, caricature, and demean the other side, right? And then they go on. Right now, Americans are not interested, on average, in dating or marrying across the political divide. So then it continues, right? And it just continues where there's just very little diversity in the home on politics.
Explain what false polarization is. It's something you get at in the piece.
Yeah, this is really interesting and weirdly hopeful in a way.
Yeah.
So Republicans currently rate fellow Republicans as more hardline on taxes, immigration, and trade than they actually are. So they see their own side as more extreme than it is. And then Democrats rate Republicans as even further to the right than they are. So both sides do this in both directions, where because things are getting caricatured, because often of the way we in the media cover these controversies, where we have, you know, a pro-life spokesperson or a pro-abortion spokesperson, an anti-abortion spokesperson, you're not getting the vast majority of opinions, which are somewhere in the middle, right? And so you start to see the other side as all one thing. There's a lot of psychological reasons for that, but it suggests that we don't actually need to be as polarized as we feel, right? So the emotions and perception have outrun the reality, just as they do in other kinds of stereotyping. And why I say it's hopeful is that this is an opportunity, right? Like, if people could realize what the truth is about the other side, then they may not be quite as antagonistic as they are.
But we're living in a time when, and you point this out in the article, where we're kind of consciously sorting ourselves into echo chambers online, even in neighborhoods. I mean, this is something that the social commentator and writer Bill Bishop has pointed out. And his, you know, we've sorted ourselves into neighborhoods with people who mostly agree with us, or we're in that process. So if we're in this sorting process, how is it that we can, as you write, live with people who think differently about politics and then become de-radicalized because we're all speaking the same language or trying to find people who agree with us?
Yeah, I mean, I think some places still there are ways to find people across that divide, and those places should, it's obvious what should happen there, right? Like, if you build up the civic health and ways to have meaningful relationships and meaningful conversations across that divide, then that would definitely be a good thing to do right now. In other places, you're right, it's much harder to even access one another. And there are programs that are trying to do that. One of them is called Better Angels, where they take people from both sides and have like structured, interesting, meaningful conversations. But there are other people working on doing this online. So ironically, this same technology, right, can, if it were designed differently, do the opposite. This is the way you meet people who are different than you are, who live far away from you. But we would have to consciously design ways to do that. And right now, we've done the opposite, right? So I think there's opportunity to do social interaction online very differently. But I don't think we're close to that yet.
What has the reaction been to the piece? What are you hearing from people? And maybe not just in terms of readers, but people you know. Are people confessing how difficult it would be, you know, like secretly confessing to you, I wouldn't want my daughter to marry a Republican either, or a Democrat, or whatever it may be? I mean, I'm just wondering what, because it seems to me it's really jump-started this conversation about, gosh, maybe I am prejudiced and I didn't even think of myself in that way.
Yeah. I mean, I was worried I'd get a lot of backlash from people who feel like they're not prejudiced. They're like, you know, rationally enraged.
Yeah.
Like, they don't, you know, they feel like, why shouldn't they hate Republicans or vice versa? I got some of that, but not as much as I expected, which is kind of encouraging. I got a really nice, there's a bunch of different reactions, but I got a really nice note from a guy in Boston who heard me talking about this on the radio, and he said to himself, oh my gosh, she's talking about me. Right. And he said that he's realized that when he walks down the street, he looks at people and tries to judge if they're Trump supporters based on how they look, and that he's filled with rage for people who he disagrees with. And he doesn't like himself, you know. And he thinks about how he disagreed with George W. Bush on many things, including the Iraq War. But he didn't feel like this. Like, he didn't feel as toxic as this does. And so he wrote me this really nice note where he said he's going to try to be more like the Ands and less like Mabel, who's another character in the story who is not tolerant of political difference and sort of has this showdown with the minister, Fred Gehry, that we've been talking about over politics.
It did make me wonder, because you mentioned it, even in your own relationship where you and your husband don't always agree on politics, that you did agree on the Donald Trump part. And I was just wondering, what if you didn't? I mean, what kind of impasse would that have represented for your relationship? What kinds of questions might it have raised? Because I think a lot of people went to Thanksgiving dinner in, you know, November of 2016 feeling like they were ready for a fight and just itching, just unwilling to budge because they were so enraged.
Yeah, right. No, I went for my Thanksgiving and somebody had put up signs, one of the younger people, cousins, that said, "No talking about politics." Right. And I was like, super annoyed.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk about politics.
That's
right
all
now.
I wanted to talk about. Yeah. And but I also understand why they did that. I mean, I think it would have been really hard if my husband and I disagreed on Trump because he's such a divisive person.
Yeah.
You know, he has normalized name calling and stereotyping and just ugly, nasty, shameless behavior. Now, I think had that happened, we would be spending a lot of money on therapy right now, because when you get into that level of a divide, then you really need some help, I think, to get underneath it. Like, what is the conflict really about here? Like, why is it that we are so different on this question of Trump? And if we can understand that, then there's a lot of good that can come even from that kind of conflict. Like, there is conflict is super important. Like, that's how we get better. Like, that's how we realize how we're screwed up and how we could do better and how other people feel. And, you know, if it's handled well, and sometimes you need an expert to get through that, like a conflict mediator or a psychologist or what have you. But if it's handled by people who know how to manage conflict, then it can be hugely productive.
There's this thing the Reverend Fred Gehry told you, that the two Ans that you were talking about earlier, one who was anti-abortion, one who was, you know, pro-choice, that he says they're an example of, he says they're a kingdom of God. That's how he put it. That they're this example of a kind of lived grace is how you describe it. Would you talk about this?
Yeah, when he first said that, I sort of felt like, wow, that's a little bit of a strong statement, even for a minister, that they're the kingdom of God. But then he explained, and I sort of got what he meant, I think. You know, he was saying, you know, in many religions, not just Christianity, we are called on to love our enemies, not to tolerate them, right? And Arthur Brooks writes about this in a new book that he has out from a more conservative point of view. And I think that sounds like squishy and nice, and it's not. It's like brutal and hard and complicated. Love thy enemy, right? And it's something that requires a level of grace that I aspire to, right? And I think that's what he meant about the ants, is that they can not just tolerate the discomfort of their differences, but live comfortably with that discomfort.
Yeah.
And it makes them better people, you know? It makes them understand each other, which could turn out to be helpful. Like, who better to make the anti-abortion argument to the other Ann than the other Ann, right? Yeah. Like, they know how to speak each other's language. But even if they don't convince each other ever, then they can still work together on other things, and they do, right? So they're not, like, I think of America as like a broken marriage, basically, at this point. And And we can like banish one another and demonize one another and say we want nothing to do with one another, but we still have kids.
Yep.
Right? And if you talk to anyone who's been divorced or who's helped people get divorced, you just cannot sever that last relationship. Like you have to find ways to work together and hear each other even as you disagree.
Let me ask you this finally, because you say in the piece that maybe there isn't one recipe for fixing intolerance. I think this is something that Fred Gehry mentioned to you, that it has to be particular to the place. He said, it's not, here's the answer, but it's, what is the recipe where you are?
Right. And different places have different opportunities for this, right? And in some places, it could be that the divide is racial, right?
Yeah.
And there, too, like what Fred Gehry said is, people think the kingdom of God is somehow utopia or heaven. That's not what Jesus meant. It's about living eternity in a moment when you treat other people with compassion and decency. So in some places, it might be a class divide, mm-hmm. right? In some places, it might be the political divide. And so it's about, like, now that since I came back from Watertown, I keep my eyes open to those opportunities. So I did something I never thought I would do, which is I went to a introductory meeting about the Rotary Club in D.C.
Right.
and, you know, how politically diverse is that? Not very.
Yeah.
There is some racial diversity, not enough. But it's a way to meet people you don't normally meet and solve problems for your community together. And there are other ways. Like, luckily for me, for my work, I get to meet people who are very different than I am all the time, and I see that as just a huge privilege. But I'm trying to look for that in other ways and sort of build that and be open to it as opposed to closed.
That's Amanda Ripley. She wrote The Least Politically Prejudiced Place in America for this month's issue of The Atlantic, and she joined us from their studio there in Washington, D.C. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. Program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.